This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.
You know, making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, founding host of the podcast. I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker. My first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, Tubi, Amazon Prime. And my second feature script is done.
Yay! I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features. And I'm currently in pre-production of my third, Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep, and I used to work at Sundance.
This week, we welcome writer Charles Piper on the show to talk about writing his first feature film, Destroy All Neighbors, which premiered on Shudder. Charles is also a director in his own right, so we talk a little bit about his short directing and, you know, balancing, you know, writing features to directing his shorts. After that, we play another round of You're the Expert. But first, Liz, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. I am meeting an actress on Friday. Like, she liked the script enough that she's willing to meet. And it's the first time I'm meeting an actress for this project, Best Friends Forever. And I was telling my producers, I don't have 100% track record with these meetings. Like, a lot of people are like, you get the meeting, all you have to do is not offend them, and then they're in. It's like, no. I have somehow offended like 50% of the people I have met. So I'm going to try to not have coffee and just be calm and like nice and like buy her a Danish and try to talk her on this project. Yeah.
I'm going to buy her a Danish.
that's the way to do it. That's the way to cast movies, right? You just give some baked goods and you're in.
Well, that's very exciting. I now want to hear about what went wrong in actor meetings before, why you have a 50% success rate. It's probably not really all everything to do with you. It's probably a lot to do with the project, right? Or
yeah, I think the actresses wanted and were willing to meet with me, but that they didn't feel that they were right. So like in two of the situations, the actresses later on were like I had tried to like rewrite the role for them. Like there were back and forths about whether they felt like that was the role that they were meant to play. So it's not, yeah, maybe it wasn't me, but I do. But I'm just saying, like, it's not a given, and I have to treat it in that way, right? I have to treat it in the way of, like, this is an opportunity. Don't fuck it up, Liz.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good way to treat anything. Like, you always want to, like, go into it like you are not taking anything for granted. Nothing is, like, a given, because I think, like, if you start to feel that way, that's when things can go terribly, terribly wrong.
Yeah. I mean, don't buy the Danish. Yeah.
If you don't buy the Danish, you say, you buy me a Danish, then you're in trouble.
Waiting for them to get their credit card out, right? And that awkward pause. What's going on with you?
I want to ask one more question.
Oh,
can you tell us anything about this actor? Like, what level they are? Are they, like, in things that we would have seen? Are they, like, an up-and-coming comedian? Like, who is this person you're meeting with?
She's not a comedian. She's, like, the one, quote-unquote, straight actress we've gone to. Ooh. It's kind of interesting that she's the first person you wanted to meet, and she's the first person who is not a comedian that we've reached out to. If I said her name, you would not know her name. She is not a household name, but if I said who she was in a recent movie, you would know her. She's been on sitcoms. She's been in horror films. She's been in indie dramedies. It would be a win if we got her. But if we said her name, you wouldn't know it.
Are you like super excited to meet with her, or are you like a little okay?
I am, and I really want her to be in the movie, and it's for the lead role. And the lead role, I wrote in my letter to her, I was like, don't tell anyone, this is my favorite character and you're my first choice. Of course I'm telling the podcast. She won't listen to the podcast, so I think it's okay.
Probably but not. Probably maybe not. To research you, who knows?
No, she's stupid.
Oh, but this will come out after your meeting, so it'll be fine.
Yeah, so by the time I listen to this recording, I will know whether the meeting went well or not. Weird.
Amazing.
Yeah.
What's going on with me? Yeah, so I'm in the hard part now of writing. To me, I feel like it's all hard. Like, it took me 4 years to write this movie, so it's very challenging. Now it's like I'm getting feedback, and now I have to decide what feedback I like and what feedback I don't like. And it's funny. It's because it's like it's easy when I see a note that I don't like or a suggestion that I think is not good. It's like, that's bad. Not doing that, or, you know, appreciate the thought, but not, that's not this what I want, you know? The hard part is trying to execute a note you like, where it's like, you agree with this note, like, yes, this is a problem. This character is too much like this other character, or, you know, these characters need to be more different somehow, or, you know, whatever. It's like, or the dialogue, it sounds too similar, which is all notes I got on the alternate, right? It's like the same note that I got on my first feature, and I was somehow able to either fix them or like improve them in the actual, you know, making of the movie or whatever. But it's like, these are all work problems with script writing that I need to like get better at in general. And I feel like I, in some characters' cases, like I did a good job, but it was more like when it was easier to be like, yeah, well, this is an alien, so they wouldn't talk like, they would talk very different. So that's easy. But then like, you know, these people, it's like, oh, well, you know, they're both similar type of, have a similar energy and similar issues they're facing. So yeah, then they just kind of sound very similar, and they all swear. There's too much swearing. That's one of the biggest notes, is there's just too much cursing and there needs to be less cursing. And I mean, I had the same problem in the alternate, because I don't know if you read it, I'm sure you would agree. Just too many F-bombs.
Why is that a problem? It's an R-rated film. That's your issue. You've now made an R-rated film. Oh, well, there's nothing.
That's interesting.
Other than that, who cares that there's a lot of cursing?
I think the heart of that note is that it's just boring. And like, it takes the power away from, you know, it takes the power away from cursing if you have too much cursing, you know.
Or
Liz says no.
I don't. I disagree. I think there are just people who curse a lot. I mean, again, you love Tarantino. Think of how much cursing is in a Tarantino movie, right? It's like water to some of the characters of Tarantino films.
Yeah, totally.
So,
and that's the thing is like, this is, you know, the original, I changed the title. The title is in flux because it originally was called Pulp Science Fiction. And basically it's like the science fiction version of Pulp Fiction is like the premise of this movie. And after a couple of people read it, they were like, yeah, it's kind of more fun if you don't know it's a science fiction version of Pulp Fiction when you're reading the movie, because you discover these things as you read it, you know? So like, better not to like put your audience in that sort of mindset beforehand.
Also, don't make your movie in relation, 100% in relation to another movie, right? It's its own independent piece of art. So
it is, yeah. But I mean, that's part of the fun, is like, you know, that there's the similarities. It's not so similar that it's like a spoof or anything. Like, it's not like we have a Royale with cheese joke or anything. It's like, you know, it's just the structure and the story beats are similar, but very different. I mean, there's not like a dancing scene. There's no heroin scenes. There's no.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, if you name it that, it takes power away from you as an artist.
Right.
Because you're just
exactly
relating to this other piece of art.
Yeah, totally. I mean, there is some fun to be had in that too. But yeah, we're trying to find it in ways that are not as one-to-one, you know. But then there are going to be some one-to-one moments too, which will be fun. You know, so yeah, so that's what's going on with me. It's a challenge. I'm very excited to be editing in front of the show Amy Taylor's next short film, which she's directing soon. I know it's like a month away from production or whatever, but I'm like over here, you know, like, oh my God, it's gonna be so fun to edit a horror short. I can't wait to see the footage she gets. And the script's really cool. I'm sure you read it, but it's really fun.
No,
what, you didn't read it?
What have you learned from our interactions for the past
years? Your writing partner. I figure, like, at least you're reading your writing partner's work, if you know.
I'm sure people know that I don't want to read their work, and I will help Amy out in any other way she wants. If you're listening, Amy, I'm here for you in any other way.
Yeah, I was thinking about sending you the script for my movie, but then I kind of thought, like, maybe I would better not. Maybe just wait till the rough cut, you know, and then, like, send that to you and get your input, like, in the editorial process. That might be more fun.
Yeah, or, like, I'll read it. If you really, really, really want me to read it, I will read it. But, you know, I don't want to be part of, like, a group of five random people who are just there for disparate opinions, you know?
Well, it's never random. You know, it's always the selection of people to read it is very specific, right? It's always like, I want these people to read it because, like, and it could be as simple as, like, because they don't know me and I want fresh input. Or it could be because, you know, they do know me really well and I feel like they're going to challenge me better than somebody who doesn't know my work, you know? But yeah, I also feel like, yeah, it's interesting. Like, I did one round. I'll probably send it back to the ones who want to read it again, but then I'll also send it to, like, another round of new people who haven't read it yet, right? So I'm not going to, like, just keep on going back to the same people. It'll be like, oh, here's another person in my line. And then it'll be like, okay, fourth draft, another new person, you know, and, like, trying to, like, kind of get new different ideas as we go. And if they give me notes that are, like, changes from the original draft, then I'll know that I've made mistakes or, you know, that I'll, like, oh, I'll be going in a completely in a good direction. But I also feel like at some point I just don't care anymore. And it's like, this is the if I still like the movie and I think it's really fun, then it's not going to matter, like, what people say. Like, I'm just going to make it. If I can raise money for it, I'm just going to make it, you know. Yeah. So anyways, that's what's going on with me. What is something that you should be checking out is our Patreon page, www.patreon.com/MMIHpodcast. This is the way the show continues to live, to thrive, to survive, to grow. Thanks to every Patreon patron who has supported us over the years. We really appreciate it. It is why the show, you are why the show is continuing to happen. You should also leave us a review on iTunes. Really, really helpful to get more people to find the show. Each rating or review we get is super, super helpful. Without any more delay, here's our chat with Charles Piper.
Charlie, can you give us the elevator pitch for Destroy All Neighbors?
Destroy All Neighbors is about a struggling, would-be, pathetic prog rock musician who lives in a crumbling LA apartment. He's been struggling for years to finish an album. He works at a shitty sound studio. Everyone he feels is his enemy when really it's all he's the bullshit artist. But things get way worse when an insanely loud and overbearing neighbor moves in next door, which forces him to finally try to confront him to get him to turn his music down so he could maybe finish his. And it's a splatter comedy. So one horrible, gross thing leads to another and all goes to hell.
How many days did you shoot the film?
We had a 20-day shoot, which was not enough to comfortably do it, really, but everyone went above and beyond, and the fact that it ended up being as good as it is a testament to the crew we got, because that was a tight shoot schedule for sure.
Now, I know you're the writer, but we ask everyone this question. There's really no one who's that we protect from it. Can you talk about the rough budget of the film?
Yeah, no, I can. So Shudder originals are typically typically like 1 to 1.5. And that was not enough to make this movie, which we had budgeted at 3 to 5 due to the amount of practical effects and puppetry. And to Shudder's credit, we politely asked for a little bit more and they gave it to us. So every dollar was stretched. Everything was still, you know, a lot of favors and a lot of long nights, and it helped that a lot of us were friends and people who knew each other and were on the same wavelength. But yeah, so that was the budget. We could have used more, but we got more. And I have nothing but love for Shudder for helping us the way they did.
Can you talk about the origin of the idea and, like, how you became involved with the project?
I literally started writing this 10 years ago because I had an abrasive, horrible, coke-fueled alcoholic neighbor who lived right behind this wall. And he kept me up all night blaring EDM and 80s music and howling. He installed a stripper's pole in his living room because of the amount of prostitutes he was bringing back and paying to dance for him.
Wow.
It was beyond the pale. It was insane. And I started to lose it a little bit. So I started complaining to my music video director friend, Josh Forbes. Turns out he also had a psychotic neighbor living next to him. And his wife was just about to give birth to their first baby. So he was on high alert. And the psychopath would yell things through the wall about what he would do to their family. Like, it was awful.
Oh my God.
Really scary shit. So we kind of looked at each other and Josh was like, there's a movie in here. Let's start brainstorming this. And he was clever. It still took a long time to get made, but he was right, because what he said was, Charlie, I have more professional directing credits and I've done a lot of music videos. You've done more writing. What if you write it for me to direct? Maybe we'll get it made easier. And it took 10 years, but that is how we got it made. And he ended up being the man who directed it.
Well, you kind of answered this question, but the question is, how long did you spend working on the film from the idea to its release? Yeah. Maybe a little bit more color about the when the script was locked versus financing. Boy.
So I probably spent a year and a half, 2 years as the sole first writer on it for Josh 10 years ago. And at the end of that process, Josh reached out to Jonah Ray Rodriguez because they had, I think they'd worked together on one music video or something. And Jonah really liked it. He was like, you can say I'm attached. If that helps you ever get a budget, I'll be in it. Didn't help at all at the time. But what he said, which was great, was he was like, I love this script. I love the energy and tone of it. But how about we revise it to make the main character a little bit more like me? I'm not just a comedian. I'm a punk rock musician. What if he's a struggling musician? Because in my early drafts, he was a struggling illustrator, a cartoonist. He was trying to do a graphic novel because I come from a stop motion background and character designs and sketching. But when Jonah said, what if it's music? It just unlocked this whole level. It's like, of course, the neighbor's music is so crazy loud, he can't focus on his. And through him and Josh Forbes, they reached out to the first punch-up writer, Mike Benner, who's an amazing comedy writer, most known. His biggest thing, he was on Bob's Burgers in the writing room for a while. And I thought this was a great idea. It was a collaboration to start with, so I didn't have much of an ego about it. I was like, we get someone from Bob's Burgers to make our lead actor feel better in the script? Hell yeah. So then Mike did a year or two of drafts building off my script, and we sent that around town and nobody cared. And it got rejected from everywhere for all sorts of comical reasons in retrospect. And the script kind of died, and I went on to do my short film, Malika Strzok, and all these other things. Jonah Ray went on to do MST3K. Josh Forbes continued doing music videos. And it wasn't until the quarantine in 2020 when Jonah decided to resurrect the script. And at that point, he'd become friendly with Alex Winter, and he sent it to Alex Winter, and the rest is history.
Amazing. If there is one thing you could change about the film, either in process or in the final product, like, what would that be? And this could be like literally anything about
the film. I could give you a little specifics. With the caveat that I'm thrilled at the end result of the film, and it's wild and incredible and it's zany, but it is also reflective of us only having 20 days to shoot it, right? So the breakneck speed of the film was kind of baked into the script, but it was also because we just had no time to shoot everything. I love all the actors in it. All the little side characters are so great. I would like the film to have had a little bit more breathing room, because there's some things that just, they just happen because that's it. That's all we got to shoot, right? And to that end specifically, there are a couple lines of dialogue that got cut out for pacing at the very end, which explicitly state that Emily is no longer his girlfriend. She's met someone new and she's just there, the kindness of her heart, as his lawyer, because that's her job and she's a kind character. People, there have been comments like, why the hell is she still with him? And I'm like, oh, she's not. That got cut out. And also, from just a filmmaker point of view, why is she still there? Because she's an amazing actress and we didn't want her to disappear from the movie. But yeah, that specifically, I just wish those little bits of dialogue for her character arc were still in it.
Jumping right in, but back to the beginning of this project's origin. So I understand you're a writer, but you're also a director, and you made this arrangement with your creative partner that he would direct and that you would write. Is there, and I'm not trying to muckrake or whatever, but just like, did that create any tension for you? Did you ever want it to swap? Did you ever want to take the lead?
For sure. I would have loved to have been able to direct this you know, as my first feature, but I was always looking at the big picture, and I knew Josh Forbes was right. I hadn't directed any features. When I started writing this, I hadn't even done my large scale shorts yet. I was, you know, I knew then that in the eyes of the industry at large, it never would have happened. And it also, it helped that Josh Forbes is a really goofy, zany guy. I love Evil Dead 2. He loves it even more. So like, I knew I could let this go because he could pull it together. And then as it evolved over the years, and we got so many wonderful people attached to it, it did make that process easier. But yeah, of course, I can't lie. It was tough at first to be like, the only way I'll get my first movie made is if I don't direct it. And that can be very hard to come to terms with for just in general, I would say. But I'm very, very glad I let this go, because the end result is this insane gonzo film that's out there and has already started to open the doors to me personally to pitch ideas that I want to direct myself and hopefully get new things going.
Yeah, it's interesting because, like, at one hand, it's like, yeah, I could hold on to this thing and, like, never let it go, you know, and then maybe it'll become nothing and it's just a sample in a drawer. Or if you have the right opportunity, like, you can let it live. And I feel like the more movies that exist in the world, the better. So, like, let's make movies, people.
Hell yeah. Every movie existing at all is an...
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.
Insane miracle. It is so tricky. Even films that come out that I don't like, I know better how hard it is, so I might not like it, but good for them to have it gotten made. And I certainly feel this with this. This was like a once in a lifetime ridiculous confluence of disparate elements that became this movie, and it's been a blast.
So here's the real question. Once the movie got picked up and Alex Winter's involved and it's going into pre-production and all these things, what was your involvement at that time? Like, are you still there with a team every day, like working on the movie, or were you kind of like hands off and like letting them go?
That was the hardest part, because once everyone got involved and it became more exciting and real, I wanted to be there every day, but it was the quarantine. This was 2020. The vaccine hadn't happened yet. So there was not much in person. And also by that time, when Alex Winter came on board, the script had laid dormant for several years. So he suggested, well, how about we get a little bit more new blood? What if we bring in this great late night comedy sketch writer I know to kind of clean it up and tie it together? So there was a second punch up writer, this guy named Jared Logan, and he did a wonderful job. And it ended up being this beautiful mix of the three of us. But because of that, I was the most removed, even though I had created it. And so I had to kind of be the kid in the back seat holding my tongue. You know, are we there yet? All I wanted to know. With that being said, though, Josh Forbes is a close friend of mine. So he kept me in the loop more so than perhaps a director who I wasn't connected to. And a lot of it, I was the one who got Gabe Bartolos involved to do the special effects, because I'd worked with him before on my short film. And I was an assistant painter and animator at his effects company over a decade ago. That was my day job when my nighttime is being kept up by the crazy neighbor. So even though I wasn't explicitly in the room as it got into pre-production, into production, it was still kind of my team and my energy. So I knew it was in the right hands.
Nice.
Do you have any color on, like, the diplomacy of those conversations? Or, I mean, was that a conversation between you and Josh? Or, like, did you bring it up? Or I'm just so curious about this, and I'm sorry to press it so much. It's just fascinating to me.
Yeah, no, I mean, Josh and I were on the same page. Like, we always wanted Vlad to be this kind of over-the-top prosthetics character, because the concept was we're seeing this from the point of view of William, who's a self-obsessed, arrogant piece of shit, who's so focused on himself, he inherently dehumanizes all those around him without even realizing it. Like, Vlad is a Romanian immigrant who left a war and came to America to start over. He has anger issues. He's a bit of a dick, but we see him through the eyes of an asshole, right? So we always knew we wanted prosthetics. Initially, Josh Forbes almost thought, what if he's fully like a puppet? What if he's like this insane, gross Muppet? But then, of course, once Alex Winter was an option. He's like, oh no, it has to be Alex Winter, but in prosthetics. So yeah, Josh and I, there was a lot of texting between him and I about kind of things going, but then, you know, the actual email chains where the producers involved with Alex and Joan and Josh talked to Gabe. I wasn't on that. I wasn't at some of their initial meetings because the writer didn't need to be there. But behind the scenes, I kind of got that ball rolling. And the same goes for the stop motion intro credit sequence, which I love. That was done by Rich Zim, who's a legendary stop motion animator. He's one of the lead character animators on The Nightmare Before Christmas, James and the Giant Peach, the Gumby reboot in the 90s, and me coming from stop motion. The very first draft of this script I started 10, 11 years ago was we fly through a stop motion crazy tunnel, right? Like, so I'm there, even though I did take a back seat and let everyone else kind of push it over the finish line.
So you were working on this movie for a very long time. Like, this was like, you know, your kind of core idea 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Now that it's done and like so many other people have touched it and it's grown to this much bigger thing, like, how do you feel about it? Like, what's your feeling now that it's out in the world and people are seeing it? Like, you know, what's that experience like?
It's been an overwhelming blast, but it was also very frazzling at first because I wasn't on set every day. I wasn't involved with the post-production. I did not see the final finished cut of the film until its world premiere night at the Arrow. You know, there's like 400 people in the audience and I'm there. My parents flew in from New Jersey to be there, which was adorable. I'm very close to them. They're awesome theater people. But so I was so focused on making sure they're seated okay. I was there with my new girlfriend. That was the first night she met my parents, let alone a ton of my film friends. It was overwhelming. And the film is such a nonstop loud onslaught that I wasn't sure what I thought about it after that screening. It was just too much to take. And it wasn't until I rewatched it a day or two later, just here in my apartment on Shudder, where I could focus on it. And then it clicked together and I was like, oh, wow, no, this is actually pretty good. It's not exactly what it was when I started it, but it became something funnier, sillier, sweeter, and more heartfelt, which ironically, or maybe coincidentally enough, aligns more with how I feel about myself and even the concept of friends and neighbors than it did when I started. You know, when I started writing this, I was in my early 20s. I was cranky. I was angry. I was literally tired all the time because of being kept up by the neighbor. My initial draft was a slower, stinkier descent into hell, way less entertaining. Now, 10 years later, it's this heartfelt, beautiful thing where it's all gore and practical effects, but it evolved into this thing about, no, we should be kind. Listen to your neighbors. Like, we're all in this together. And I think that's lovely. And people either really dig that or are totally turned off by it in the film. And that's, I to those who don't dig it, I'm like, well, it sucks to be you if you're like, you can't vibe with actually being kind. Like, everything is horrible, right? Like, life is tough and it's hard and it never gets easier. But if we can just be kind of nice to each other and have some fun with it, like, I don't know. That's, yeah, that was initially more Josh Forbes than me. But in this process, I feel like I've come to embrace that too. And it's been really relaxing in a weird way.
We haven't seen the movie, just so you know.
Okay.
But looking at the trailer and the materials and your description of it being a splatter comedy, I'm a big fan of gross and I'm a big fan of excess. And
you might like this movie. This film is cranked to 11 from the get-go. It's a live-action cartoon.
Yeah,
everyone is insane. You know, I've been going into some of kind of my deeper feelings about it, but the film plays like a wacky cartoon. But it also, yeah, it does wear its heart on its sleeve, as you will see.
Well, I'm curious what the style or concept inspirations for you are for playing those kind of things till 11. Like, Ulrich and I always talk about society, and you just mentioned Evil Dead 2. Are there other things that inspire you?
I could send you guys this link later. Josh and I created a sizzle trailer out of old horror movie footage to try to sell this 10 years ago. And, you know, it's got Barton Fink in it. It's got Evil Dead 2. It's got American Werewolf in London. It's got Taxidermia, the giant bloated man from Taxidermia is in it. And what's crazy is one of my favorite bands is this band called Man Man. And I've been a fan of theirs since 2005. We put their music in that trailer because we liked the vibe of it. The lead singer of that and guitarist ended up doing the soundtrack for this film. And the lead singer plays a musician in the film. So that's been another level of just But yeah, the initial way that I'm pretty sure Josh pitched this to Jonah, that email was, the film is going to be Barton Fink meets Evil Dead 2 and you'll be Barton.
So you're talking a little bit about opportunities since the movie has come out and been released. Mm. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like, did you get representation from this? Did you already have representation? Like, what kind of opportunities have come?
The opportunities have still been kind of me tooting my own horn and pushing it out there, but now with a little bit more confidence because the film came out. So I have no manager. I have no agent. I have been in LA since 2009, and I've always been trying to get one. And when I made that large scale, horrifying short film, Malacostraca, I thought, like, this is a hell of a calling card. Well, it scared people too much and it disturbed people. So I got rejected from horror movie companies because they said it was too uncomfortable for them. So I guess I did my job very well. Thank you very much. But that was annoying as hell. I cannot describe to you how frustrating it was. They were like, this is too horrific. We don't want to work with you. All right. Thanks a lot, Good Fear. Wow. You know what I mean? Okay. Mm. And then when this script got sold and I finally had like an IndieWire website article, in my youthful naivete, I thought, ha cha cha, I finally made it. I must have sent 300 emails over the course of a month, targeted towards literary managers and agents that represented horror clients or kind of just more gonzo filmmakers. I must have gotten, I think I got 5 responses, which led to 2 Zoom meetings. And the one guy who seemed the most interested in me, he ended up getting caught in a lie and was too embarrassed to talk to me further. And what I mean by that was, my email was like, hi, I'm the writer of this upcoming Shudder horror comedy. Here's the link. It's this crazy gonzo thing. I myself do horrors. Here's my short. And this older gentleman from one of the bigger agencies, he hadn't actually read the article. He didn't click it. So he emailed me back and forth for a while under the assumption that I was also the director of the film, even though I had never stated that because I wasn't. And he forwarded my info to a woman he worked with who had some connection to Alex Winter back in the day. And the woman was like, what are you talking about? He didn't direct. He's not directing this. And he got so embarrassed that he literally called me to say, I can't take a client who hasn't already directed their first feature. I'm sorry. And that's not how this works. But he was just embarrassed. So that was this weird object lesson where I was like, wait, the film hasn't been made yet. It still hasn't come out. I'm still nothing. Like, don't focus on trying to get an agent. Let me focus on writing more screenplays. So when this comes out and hopefully does well, I have a back catalog to send out, which is what I ended up doing. And now that's kind of what I'm targeting. I have one literary manager reading a couple of my scripts. I've reached out to a couple others. Of course, I have an in with Shudder now. So we'll see what happens. But it's still, I would love a manager just so I don't have to do all the heavy lifting myself, but it's also not my end all be all. I got one film made without one. I could do it again. I'm pretty sure it just might be harder, but what's hard? Nothing's easy. Making any movie. I love the name of this podcast because like I feel that in my bones. It's hard to make a movie and it's always an uphill battle. And I am extremely aware of what a statistical anomaly I am right now with this film. I'm very happy about that, but I also know it just speaks to how hard it is in general.
For what it's worth, you know, because we do a lot of interviews with writers and directors, and most of the people who have reps don't say that their agents and managers do any heavy lifting at all, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, that's fair.
It always feels like the burden is on us, and it sounds like you've done a lot with what you've got so far.
It is a burden I am very used to now.
I want to talk briefly about Alex Winter, just because I come from the world. I work in distribution. To me, Alex Winter is a very interesting case study of someone who's very interested in direct to consumer. He's mm-hmm. very outside the box in terms of how he thinks about marketing and distribution. I don't know how much you were in on these conversations, but by the way, my entire timeline blew up last week with information about your film.
Oh, wow.
Like everyone.
Same.
And Alrix too. Like, everyone was talking about it. So I'm curious if you have any sense of how that happened. I mean, obviously it should be merit, but is it the splatter of the film? Is it Alex Winter?
Like, I think it's Alex Winter is very canny with his online marketing, and really he's the single most important reason the film got made. Without him, there's no film. Him being involved changed it from being 10 years of nobody wanting it to Shudder buying it less than a week after he said he was attached. And that in and of itself has been a dream, because one of my most important obsessive films when I was a kid in the 90s was Freaked freaked, like, blew my brain up. And it's why I kind of write the silly way I do. So the fact that I wrote something that appealed to the co-creator of Freaked is just insane. But he's a very intelligent, smart guy, and he spent so many years doing documentaries and directing on top of just acting. Yeah, Shudder realized, they're like, well, we have the Alex Winter fandom, and then we have the MST3K fandom with Jonah, and then because they're so connected to so many people, we got such a huge ensemble cast of comedians and character actors. So I think the fact that just different elements of interest combined in this film is why it blew up so hard. And to Shudder's credit, and AMC Plus, that is, too, they've been pushing it a bit. I've seen advertisements for it just pop up unbeknownst to me, just on my feeds, and it's really wild.
So you talked about, you know, this opportunity to make this movie as your first feature as a writer, yeah. You know, and now that you have this movie done, it's like you're on this kind of other level. Like you have a feature credit to your name.
Yeah.
Are you thinking about going the indie route and just doing like Malka Strakata? Sorry, I'm butchering
it. Let me put it this way. I'm never going to use the scientific Latin name for a creature as a title ever again, because it's meant, I've had to say it so much over the last 8 years, and everyone else is just like, Jesus, Charlie, what the fuck? Anyway.
But would you do that on a bigger scale as your first director feature next? Is that like something that you're considering?
There is a feature length screenplay expansion of Malika Straka that I've done, and I like it way more than the short. It goes to different places. Different things happen without spoiling it, because A, I didn't want to do such a horrible thing again, and it made no sense to have a feature length lead to such an inevitably obvious conclusion that in a claustrophobic nightmare short, that's different. And the thing is, Shudder has Destroy All Neighbors. Shudder also has the Malika Straka short as part of an anthology season they own.
Oh,
so
nice.
There is a sensible, it's like, and I haven't like, hey, you got, but with that being said, I have about 7 other screenplays I've written that I'd love to get out there. And part of me would love to just do something totally different and unexpected. But also, let's be real here. The next thing I do is whatever they want to pay me for, right? Whatever they're right. saying, let's do this. I'm not going to complain. But yeah, the Malika Straka feature would be exciting, because in many ways it's an inverse of the short, and the character dynamics are way more fleshed out. And that could be very exciting to do.
Well, I guess, man, just to press a little further, like, what about just doing any feature as your first feature, you know, in that indie way where you don't like work through Shudder, you don't work through a big company, like you just raise the money on your own. You don't make it for $1.5 million. You make it for $200,000 or $100,000 or something like that. Is that like something you're considering? Or now that you have a taste of this, you're like, no, I want to go for the big time.
I would like to keep going bigger, not just because, but I've done about 3 large scale indie film fundraisers over the course of the last decade for my shorts. And they were all successful to a point, but also nightmarish and exhausting, and literally stressed me out so hard. It fucked up my stomach, and my digestion went wrong for half a year before making Malika Straka. We lost half a year of development because I developed something comically called leaky gut syndrome. When stress physicalizes and your body is out of whack. So
I've had a friend have that.
Oh, it's awful. So I don't want to do another low budget thing unless it's like a couple of people like, well, here's a couple of chunk. If I didn't have to dance online for a month or two, I would do that. But I'm just tired of dancing.
Yeah.
Well,
interesting.
How do you make a living? Right. So it's like you're playing the development game with studios, with trying to get management, trying to get representation. What fuels your economics on a day-to-day basis?
Not much, to be honest. And this is a rent-controlled apartment that I've lived in since 2010. That helps. I'm so glad I didn't. I almost left when that neighbor, I had that crazy neighbor for 2.5 years. The only reason I finally got him evicted was I secretly filmed him in an alcoholic fugue state threatening my life. And I was able to use that footage as leverage. But
wow,
I've had day jobs. I've been a photo archivist. I've worked for independent films, making a modicum of money within art teams. Right now, I'm just kind of surviving off my savings, which are in a really low spot. And so hopefully I sell something or do something. But yeah, I feel like a crumb bum. You know, it's like every time I have to like drop $20 to get a coffee and a muffin around the corner, right? Because prices are so bad. I'm like, oh, God, it's Yeah, I made a little bit of money off Destroy All Neighbors, but not a lot because we three writers split it equally because that was the right thing to do. But what's
Wow.
funny is it meant I made so little that I didn't make enough to qualify for health insurance if I joined the WGA. So I'm not even in the WGA because that'd have been about what, like $3,000 to join. And then I still wouldn't have had health insurance. I would have just had $3,000 less from the modicum of money I made off selling this script. So I'm still not in the WGA. Maybe I never will be. I don't know. Same for the DGA. I'm in nothing. I'm a free floating radical.
Same.
Yeah. More power to the unions and all, but I'm not there yet. And maybe, who knows? I don't know. I've grown so used to just feeling like I'm this scruffy dog scratching at the back door. And with Destroy All Neighbors getting made, it's like the dog door has opened. I can walk in. I might still be on all fours, right? But we'll see what happens.
So with your shorts, how much did they cost? Like, were they like all around like the same, or were they vastly different? And then part two of this question, like you talked about like people turning you down because it was too horrific, but like the short is clearly successful, 500,000 views on YouTube, you know, and then it's got like whatever you said, it's on Shudder as part of an anthology.
Let me put
So
it
like.
this way, Malika Straka is about as successful as a short.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the Roaring Twenties. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.
Film can be in a larger environment where short films don't matter and nothing matters. And by that, I mean the two things I wanted it to do for my career, it didn't do so far. And, I shot that like in 2016, 2017. It did the fest circuit from 2018 into early 2020. Then the pandemic hit and it was primordial history. I hoped it would get me represented by management to help me move forward. And in my old, grumpy, early internet bones, I wanted it to get a Vimeo staff pick, right? Because that, for the longest time, was something I was chasing. And I know that it was seen by the Vimeo people, but it's a consensus. If one person on the staff team doesn't like it, that's it. So those two things didn't happen. It did end up on Altr, and it has all those views on YouTube, which mean shit, to be honest. Like, it looks good on paper, but they're all just it's teenagers watching it and writing a comment like, "That was the craziest thing ever." That's cool. Altr and I, like, there's no relationship there so far. I reached out to them with some of my features and stuff, and Altr is a small group that are so focused on populating their platform with shorts that I don't know. I don't feel connected to it, so to say. But yeah, it's a successful short. And in the long run, will the feature get made? I'm pretty sure it will. But again, because I don't give up, not because of any help that others gave it, I think. That sounds so rude, but I can't help but kind of feel that. But that also might just me having a chip on my shoulder a little bit. So.
Well, it's all optics, right? Like, you know, I
True.
have a short that's got like 200,000 hits on YouTube, but yours has got 500,000. So like if you're looking at two directors, it's like
Yeah.
one, it's like, oh, this one's more impressive. Altr. Oh, I've heard of Altr
Yeah.
before. You know, it's like those kinds of things. So I wouldn't like shit on yourself too much because it is a pretty good
That's fair.
accomplishment.
I
I
think
mean,
I've
I've
just
had
been
like three
so used to
shorts,
shitting on myself.
like I've
I
had
gotta
three
get
shorts,
over it.
like, you know, like rejected by Altr, you know, and Dust, you know. And so like I just feel like, you know, you gotta take the victories, right? And then like work that into your thing that you when you're reaching out to people, you know.
Oh yeah, no, moving forward. I mean, well, it's also this tricky thing is Destroy All Neighbors is as tonally different from the Malika Straka as possible. And I like that. I like the extremes, extremely dark, extremely silly. But there's also a lot of sillier stuff that I'm trying to kind of lead with because if Destroy All Neighbors is doing well, like maybe that's what people are looking at right now.
Yeah,
So
but they both show like your aptitude for writing for special effects, right? Like, and like
yes.
as a director, the Malika Straka part of it, like that shows that you can handle guiding a team with those kinds of effects, which is
True.
not an easy
Yeah.
thing. So I don't know. I'm just trying to pump you up a little bit here,
Oh, I
man.
appreciate
You
that.
know, like
Thank
you,
you.
I think
Yeah.
you've got more going for you than you, especially around the shorts, you know.
Sure. Well, that'll be great. And no, don't get me wrong. Malika Straka is gorgeous looking, and it looks great. I love the acting in it. My cinematographer, Ava Shore, I think she's the best cinematographer of my generation. She is incredible, and I want to work with her again. You know, if we get to do the feature, she's the first DP I hopefully get involved with it. And yeah, and working with Gabe has been a blast. Like, I grew up watching Gabe's Monsters, you know. He did Basket Case 2 and 3 and Brain Damage. He did all of Matthew Barney's Cree Master Cycle. If you remember when Bjork wore the swan dress and dropped the egg, that was Gabe's egg. Okay, this guy is... So it's been wonderful. I hope anything I direct that has practical effects, he's got my go-to guy. So moving forward, I just want to keep the family together, so to say, you know?
Shout out to Ava, previous guest on the show.
Oh, no shit. Oh,
yeah,
awesome.
She's fantastic. Yeah, it was a really great conversation about shooting... I think it was either her first feature or one of her early features. So it was really, cool.
I'll
but yeah, awesome that you, that's probably where I recognized, cause I saw the poster and I was like, I know I've seen that before. And it's probably cause working, looking at her reel and
stuff.
Sure.
Yeah. No, Ava and I, we met at a Halloween party like 12 years ago. I was Jack Nicholson frozen to death at the end of The Shining. And she was also Jack Nicholson from The Shining, but like just alive in blood. And it was, the party had been kind of lame up to that point. So I was literally just sitting in a chair looking grumpy, looking like the freeze frame from the end of the movie. And she walks in the front door and she sees me, I see her. We burst out laughing. We've been friends ever since. Yeah, what a dream.
I just want to acknowledge and apologize for the rotating amount of children that have appeared on your Zoom screen for the past 20
Hello,
minutes.
Kids. Now, don't get me wrong. I love kids. People worry about that because of Malika Straka, but that was just me trying to come up with like, what was the scariest, deepest fear for me? You know, I'm not anti-kid at all.
No, I think it's great, by the way. I love your short, just to say that plainly. It was very terrifying, not just the ending, but the whole part. I love the way you use the cinematography and the performances and the shot selection. Mwah. Beautiful.
Thank you.
I want to push back, well, not push back, but push into this conversation about the chip on the shoulder or the being hard on oneself. There seems to be this kind of like going back and forth between, am I hard enough on myself? Am I not hard enough on myself? Do I deserve this? Do I not?
Sure.
And also this interplay between being a writer, pushing that forward, and being a director and pushing that forward. So I'd just be curious. I understand you don't want to fundraise anymore, but...
I mean, if I have to, I will, but I don't want to.
It's not, it's not, you're not clamoring to do it, but in terms of micro budget projects or just this itch to direct, is that prevalent for you or is it?
No, it's nonstop. I mean, I've wanted to make movies since I was six. I literally, the first horror comedy I made was on a VHS camera with my parents in my New Jersey living room in like 1992 called Murders at the Halloween Hotel. And my parents and I played all the characters. There's footage of this online. I made a trailer for it. And that's now something I'm developing as a possible feature to direct as like the ultimate horror comedy. But no, I've been obsessed with filmmaking. And yeah, I wanted to be a stop motion animator. I wanted to be an effects artist. But really, I write to hopefully direct myself. And Destroy All Neighbors was this kind of, you know, acceptance of realizing, okay, I got to let someone else do this to get it made. And I'm so grateful I did. But moving forward, yeah, I want to direct my own scripts, but I also wouldn't mind directing other people's scripts if I like it. I did one short after Malika Straka called When We Dance, which was someone else's script. It was a screenwriter I'd met at FilmQuest, where Malika Straka premiered, a wonderful guy named Kenny Wright, which is a wonderful last name for a writer. And he sent me this short. He sent me a couple shorts. And the one I was most drawn to was the least horrific. This one, it's kind of a romantic midlife crisis, sad old man story with a wonderful flashback to the 1960s that I thought would be fun to do in a low budget way. And I was like, that's so different from Malika Straka. I want to do that. So we did the short, came out all right, much lower budget than Malika Straka. And then it barely went anywhere on the film fest circuit because it wasn't horror enough. So the horror festivals couldn't take it, but it had a little bit of a, I don't know, I'm proud of that short, but that was fun. That was fun. Just even directing someone else's script. It was a fun collaboration.
I guess just to go even further, I mean, many different filmmakers don't have the talent to write, right? Mm. Like a lot of us have a hard time writing. We want to direct, but writing is, you know, squeezing blood from a stone experience for us. I'm not trying to be too specific.
No, I mean, I feel that. I have trouble writing a lot. You know, there's so much of this insane, toxic positivity, screenwriter hustle lifestyle on Twitter with like, I'll get up at 4 a.m. and I'll crank out 20 pages before the sunrise. I'm like, are you okay? What I do is every day that I set out to write, my goal is 5 pages. And sometimes I make that. Most days I don't. But even if I don't, even if I just eke out a page and a half, 2 pages, it's still incremental growth.
Well, I love that. But just to, again, push back, I'm on a track here of why not just write an incredibly low budget project for yourself right now?
I've tried to come up with ideas like that forever. And it's just, I don't know. I it's hard for me to write just like a two-hander or something just in a room. I like what drew me into filmmaking at the beginning was the wild visuals, the practical effects, the monsters, the craziness, doing something that you can't do in reality. So my brain is still situated that. And I'm such a visual. Malika Straka grew out of a visual that popped into my head out of the blue when I was in college and was a short story first. And yeah, your question is apt, and it would be wonderful if I could come up with like a low budget thing I could do quickly, or not quickly, but easier, so to say, compared to something big like this. But so far, I just haven't found the idea.
I have a question about shorts versus features. There's a lot of talk with previous guests, like that some people think, oh yeah, low budget feature, that's the way to excel your career. Like go out, make a feature for whatever you can. The more features you have, the better you are as a commodity. Other people say, no, short films, a high quality $20,000, $15,000 short film that could get into big festivals, that's going to way better to propel your career. Like, where do you fall on that line?
Let me put it this way. Having done a very large scale, good looking short film that was about as successful as a short film could do, but did nothing for my career, I would have thought, you know, if I go back, the amount of money that ended up going to Malika Straka, I could have had a feature film for that same amount. Low budget, it wouldn't have been Malika Straka, the feature film, but I'm proud of Malika Straka. But yeah, it did not swing the needle so far in any direction at all. It will, okay? But only because of my obsessive drive and pushing out Destroy All Neighbors and other stuff. I would think, it's also just a weird time because who watches anything and everything is chaos and insane. But I would think coming out of the gate swinging with a low budget feature film, that's pretty cool. That means a lot more than making a cool looking short film. Because other than folks like us, who watches short films? Nobody. Yeah. I'm sorry to say. Like, we are our own ecosystem. Yeah. Or that's how it's felt to me. With all the views of Malik Strock online, not a single one of those views was from someone that could make it into a feature so far, right? So we'll see. But no, make a feature film. Make a low budget feature film, I think. I wish I had.
And you still can.
True. Okay, fair point. Very fair point.
Let's jump into our final Inside the Actor Studio-y questions, Charlie. What's the first film you ever made? I mean, we kind of heard about it already, this home video. Yeah. And how do you feel about it right now?
I think it's adorable and it's great. It was Murder at the Halloween Hotel. Then a year or two later, my parents and I did the sequel called Revenge of Halloween Hotel. I play multiple characters in it. My dad's in a Crypt Keeper mask. I puppeteered a Critters hand puppet that they bought me from the back pages of Fangoria. For the longest time, I kind of left horror comedy and I went deadly serious with Malika Straka and all these other things. But the horror comedy came up and now I feel like it's been giving me license to be funnier and sweeter. Even if I do make the Malika Straka feature, there will be more comedy in it, I think. Because I think at my core, that's maybe who I am and I'm coming to accept that, which is kind of sweet, but weird.
What's the best filmmaking advice that you've ever received?
The best filmic advice is a screenwriting advice I got from a friend of mine, a wonderful screenwriter named Avishai Weinberger. He'd gotten this advice from, I think, a film teacher of his. And the advice was, imagine you get $100 for every single word you can cut out of your screenplay without losing the plot. Because less is more on the page and it's very easy to overwrite a screenplay. But yeah, I've kept that advice in my head and my screenplays are tighter and more readable now while still working, I think. Because yeah, a screenplay should be easy to read. It should be more white on the page than black ink. A screenplay that someone can read quickly that might help you get it made, that's where it all starts.
I love that advice. Can you share some bad advice that you've experienced or witnessed?
Man, bad advice would be, you know, oh, this is cool, but this is in right now. So what if you made it like this? Or just any bad advice in general is advice where it's not so much advice. The worst is when someone thinks they're giving you notes, but the notes aren't about how to make the script better. It's more about what they want it to be, right? Yeah. Like, you have to be very canny. You got to be open to notes. And I will say some of the best ideas I've ever gotten in my films have come from other people suggesting things from an open mind. And that's great. But there's also a lot of just bad notes that come from other people's, you know, well, you know, it's just like when you see a silly review, it's like, well, I saw the trailer and I thought this film would be different, so it sucks. That's not the film's fault, right? That's the marketing's fault, or you for not doing the research into what the vibe is. Yeah, just the worst advice would be to bend away from what you want to help something get made. Because why get something made if it's not your brain baby, I suppose.
Love it. Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
My goal would be to continue to get to do things I enjoy doing with the people I enjoy making them with. You know, I'm not trying to be the king of the castle or like some new giant Hollywood god. I just think it would be great if, like, yeah, I get to make a movie, one or two movies every couple of years moving forward, and just have a semi-steady career making weird stuff. That would be great.
If you could go back in time, what's the one piece of advice you'd give yourself?
Don't take Accutane. I had an unscrupulous dermatologist accidentally overdose me on Accutane when I was in college, and I nearly died. And it took about a decade of psychological work to help me get through what that did to me. And it was awful. Long story short, I love David Cronenberg, but living inside a David Cronenberg film when I was 20 in college fucking sucked. I sometimes look back and I'm amazed I got out of it alive and got to LA while I was still going through these side effects that were horrifying. I do have a film I wrote about this that maybe I'll get made, which there'll be a nice capper on it. But yeah, don't trust doctors explicitly. Do your be canny, or don't trust any, well, you know, or people in power. Yeah, I literally almost died when I was 20 and it was horrible. So,
wow, that's rough. Sorry to hear about that. Glad okay. You're good now.
I'm on the other side of it now, clearly. But yeah, it was a lot.
All right, and last question, is making movies hard?
Oh, it's the hardest thing in the world, I suppose, or especially to do consistently or to do in a way that reflects who you are. But it's all I've ever wanted to do since I was a kid. It's how my brain is wired, for better or for worse. Now, making movies is hard, but it's very rewarding, too, if you can fight the good fight for long enough.
Amazing. So where should people go if they want to watch Destroy All Neighbors or any of your shorts? Where should they go? This is plug time.
For sure. Destroy All Neighbors is currently streaming on Shudder for now until the end of time. It's also available through AMC Plus as an additional add-on to Amazon Prime. For folks here in LA, there's going to be a special screening of it at the Vidiot's Theater in Eagle Rock at the end of the month. For folks in London, there's going to be a screening of it at the start of next month, I believe, at the Prince Charles Cinema, which is very cool. And then beyond that, if people are interested in looking up my stuff, I'm C Piper at Instagram. I'm Inherent Charlie on Twitter. And a lot of my shorts animations are on my website, just charlespiper.com.
Liz, what do you remember from our chat with Charles?
My favorite part about talking to Charles Piper is that weeks after we recorded the interview, he emailed us presuming that the interview went so poorly that we weren't going to share it on our podcast. And it was like a very kind of sweet, sweet email because it was presumed failure, which gets me, as we know. I'm all about failure. And it made me feel like he was humble and kind. And of course, the interview didn't go poorly. Of course, we were going to show it. But it made me like him more that he had assumed the worst. And that's what I have to say about that. What about you?
It's funny. That's not the first time that's happened that someone has emailed us like, OK, I guess it was so terrible that you shit canned it. Not happening. And it's like, no, we just take really long to release our shows. You told us no deadline. So then Ulrich over here, Mr. Programmer Extraordinaire, goes, I could push this episode back for 3 months.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. And we actually did push it back one more week without telling him because I had to fit in another guest for a release, you know, but that's just the way it goes. But no, what I remember is that Charles is really an impressive filmmaker. Like, he has a really cool short film that is terrifying. You know, you should not watch if you recently had a child because it is terrifying. But it was really well made, and it's got like, I can't remember how many it has, but it's like, I think well over 500,000 views online. Like, it's been watched by many, many people. And he's got his first feature that premiered on Shudder. And I felt like his reaction to these successes was like, they aren't successes, that they're all failures. And I was like, you know, man, like, and like, that's understandable. Like, we always devalue our work, right? Like, we always look at what we've done and we're like, yeah, it wasn't as good as it should have been, whatever, whatever. But I feel like, you know, I hope that from our conversation, Charles took away that, like, yeah, dude, you kick ass. Like, you have this movie that did really well, and you have this other movie that is, like, being seen by many, many thousands of people, you know, through Shudder, and, you know, was reviewed, I think, pretty well. So, like, yeah, you should be stoked. And, you know, I feel like, you know, embracing our projects is important no matter what happens with them, even if they are quote unquote failures. Like, we should still embrace the positive sides of them. But if they are actually successes, we should definitely be like talking about them as successes, because it's like, we've talked about this on the show before, and I've gotten shit from it, from I think you, and definitely from Matt Enlow and from some other people on the show, of like putting down my work and like not being like a positive and excited enough about like what has happened, like specifically with the alternate, I think. And, you know, yeah, I'm super proud of that movie. Like, yeah, did I get an agent from it? No. Am I directing the next X-Men movie? No. But, you know, did it get seen by lots of people, and do people write me nice lit messages about it? And did it have a positive impact on the genre filmmaking community? Yeah, to some degree, I think it did, you know, and I'm really proud of it. I love the way it turned out. And, you know, the fact that I get, you know, I've got a like fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes, you know, got all these rewards, you know, I mean, I feel like I did it. I nailed it. You know, I'm feeling great. I'm really excited to make the next one. So I don't know, Charles. I hope you don't feel like we're crapping on you, because we're not.
We're doing the opposite. We're doing the opposite of crapping on Charles.
No, yeah, I was feel like, you know, he was seemed a little glum, but it was like a deep therapy session, I think, was what the episode was. And like, that's what it is for most people. But this one went really, you know, kind of deeper in that. And I think it was good. And I hope that people really enjoy the episode. And I want to hear what other people think, you know, and like how they relate to their own work. Like, yeah. I'm sure a lot of people can relate to this conversation. But Liz,
it's time for You're the Expert. You're the Expert is a segment that Eric Toms dreamed up, where he gathers questions from listeners, or from himself, but mostly from listeners, where he believes that we have an expertise in the answer and can provide one. So this week's question is, and I really think, Alric, that these are appropriately themed to where you are in your process. Like, every week, it seems it's just very coincidental. But the question is, how do you know if you're ready to make a feature film? So, Alric, how do you know?
That's a really hard question to answer. I feel like, to me, a lot of how you know is due to time, right? Like, and so, like, you probably never hear me say, oh, I made my movie in 6 months or a year, because part of the reason, the way of telling that I'm ready to make a movie is that, like, after years of living with a story to some extent, that I still like it and I still love it. And then, like, when I've sent it out to people to read and people are like, you know, enthusiastic or less enthusiastic, or they love parts, they hate parts, that, like, I still look at it and say, this movie is awesome, I'm super excited to make this movie. I think, like, once those answers have been given to myself through time and through working on it, I think that's when I know I'm ready to make this movie. It's like, it still needs to mean something to you after years of looking at it and, like, people telling you that it's not good. I think that's also important. Like, people told me, many, many people, like, who I pitched the alternate to, told me that it wasn't, you know, a movie I should make, or it wasn't going to be successful or whatever. Like, I heard lots of negatives about that movie in the process of trying to raise the money. And lots of people who said, oh, it's cool, but I don't want to put my money in it, or whatever, you know. And after all that you still are like, no, this thing is fucking awesome and I want to make it and I can't wait to make it. You know, it's like, if you still have that, then, like, you're winning, you know, and that's the movie that you should make. But I feel like you can't really know that unless you spend, like, a couple years with it, really, you know. And, like, I've already spent 4 years writing this script that I'm working on now. So I'm already feeling like it's a pretty good sign that this movie is going to get made by me. I think it's going to happen. I kind of feel it right now. But anyways, how about you, Liz? How do you know you're ready to make a movie?
Well, I mean, I think implicit in that is two questions. One is like, when, how do you know if it's the right script? Which I think you're answering a lot of that, right? It's like, if you continue it to work on it, you want to improve it, you feel attached to it, you can see it, you know, those are all reasons. But when do you, how do you know, like, you're ready to turn that into a feature film and really make the commitment to make that script into a movie? Like, for me, I kept thinking about that scene in When Harry Met Sally, which I've seen gazillions of times, but there's like these interstitial interviews with couples and the characters are like, I knew the way I knew about a good melon. Like, and that's how I feel about the project. It's like, you hold a melon, you knock it a few times, you hear if it's hollow, you feel like this is the melon I want to take home and purchase. That's how you know you that script should be turned into a movie. It is, for me, very instinctual. And I remember going through with Amy Taylor, who is now the co-star of this episode, but Amy Taylor and I went through like 45 million drafts of Best Friends Forever, the film that I'm making right now. And we did like weird witch drafts and weird like drafts inspired by different genres and subgenres of horror. But something clicked into gear in that last iteration of what we were working on where we both looked at each other and we said, I feel this is the right one. So for me, it's the same way you feel about a melon. You feel that it's right.
I can't believe that you compared making a movie to picking a melon.
It's the same thing.
Hilarious.
It's and you know, and you could be wrong, right? Like, you end up having a disgusting melon at home, but like you picked it. Like, it's all based off of that emotional, instinctual experience. Does anyone else feel this way? I always feel like I'm calling out to the void in this part because like no one ever responds. But you could respond about the melon thing or about
the melon thing.
For anything else in life. You want to talk about politics? No. If you want to talk about the weather, email us podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. If you like the show, you could review us on iTunes. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast, YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Thanks to Charles Piper for coming on the show. Thanks to Paul Egas for the recommendation. Thank you, Paul. Thank you to our editor, Jeff Reimut, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert California Jones for handling all of our social media. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome. Most importantly, thanks to all of you for listening, and talk to you all next week.
But the hard part would be No, stop talking. Go watch a movie. It will be set up.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.